Since Holy Week, I've been having these recurring images of rooms. I've dreamt about rooms. What I share with you now is not so much a sermon as a meditation, a conversation going on between three rooms. First, there is the upper room, that little known but frequently cited location where Jesus gathered with his disciples to share the Passover meal on the night he was betrayed. The Gospels give us different accounts of what happened here. Passover is the liturgical meal that Jews have celebrated every year for millennia, recalling the miraculous escape from Egyptian bondage and the long, slow journey into a land of freedom. When Jesus celebrated the Passover with his disciples, he made an unsettling and profound addition to the liturgy. Take and eat. This is my body. For many Christians, this upper room close encounter with Jesus is central to faith and practice. John's gospel, in contrast to the synoptics, has no meal as such, but we're told that Jesus washed the disciples' feet. Peter, reluctant to receive this act of service. John's Gospel also has a long teaching section of five chapters called the Final Discourse, and the text we heard today comes from this section. Many beloved lines are found in the Final Discourse. Do not let your hearts be troubled. I am the vine, you are the branches. Peace I give you. So what about the upper room? Earlier, we know the disciples asked Jesus where he wanted to celebrate the Passover. Jesus instructed them to go and find someone who would provide them with a large, furnished upper room. They did as they were told and prepared the room for the meal. I wonder, in whose house was this room? Had Jesus and the disciples been there before? Was this a room where they frequently gathered? Was the owner a follower or a friend of Jesus? A sympathizer, but undeclared in faith and following. Who did the cooking? The Passover is a festive meal with lamb and a range of other foods. Did the host provide these for Jesus? Were there women who cooked, served, ate together with the 12? Some of us may have Da Vinci's Last Supper painting in our minds with all its interesting and mysterious possibilities. You can see a slide of it on the PDF. Is that Mary Magdalene seated next to Jesus? Or John, the beloved disciple? Either way, one can see a room that is large and open rather than small and close. That's in keeping with archaeological research. But let's be clear, we're in the territory of conjecture. Some traditions say that the house with the upper room, not an uncommon feature in the homes of the wealthy, belonged to Mary, the mother of John Mark, who we hear about in the book of Acts. Others say the house belonged to Nicodemus, the ruler who came inquiring of Jesus at night. Carl preached on this text in Lent. I had pictured this as an intimate, cozy room, but that's unlikely. While it seems to have provided privacy, it was likely a large room, perhaps with windows open to the breezes and views below. Da Vinci's painting shows it like this. In any case, it seems clear that this location became one of significant encounters. What Christians call the Last Supper, then the post-resurrection visits of Jesus to the disciples, a first round on Easter Sunday evening, and then a second visit 7 days later with Thomas present. Thomas Bona preached from this text several weeks ago. These gospel stories happened here in the upper room. Many would also place the events of Pentecost in the upper room as well. The Pentecost stories are in the first two chapters of Acts, and that comes next week. So how might we describe this place? A meeting place. A hiding place. A confusing place. a place of close encounters, a place of peace, a place of blessing and sending. Over time, the upper room has come to signify meaning, connection, epiphany. The early church may have met in the upper rooms before persecution forced a move to catacombs, lower rooms. This week I learned that W.B. Yeats and several other poets met regularly in a place called the upper room. The upper room is a well-respected progressive publisher of ecumenical devotional guides and books, begun over 90 years ago in Nashville, Tennessee. It's also the name of several loosely connected independent congregations, some of which are here in Indiana. I don't know if they actually meet in upper rooms. Second, the room where it happens. Some time ago, my friend Nancy and I went to Chicago to see Hamilton to celebrate our birthdays. What an amazing show. There are lots of memorable songs, but near the top of my list is The Room Where It Happens. It's a kind of lament sung by Aaron Burr, trying to figure out how Alexander Hamilton was able to persuade his enemies, Jefferson and Madison, to accept his plan for the banking and financial structures of the new nation. As a part of the compromise, the U.S. Capitol was moved to the South, to what would become Washington, D.C., rather than New York City, its location from 1785 to 1790. The lyrics are fascinating, and the refrain keeps coming back. I want to be in the room where it happens. Burr has witnessed the contentious, deadlocked public process of forming a new nation. And suddenly a shift occurs, and a compromise is found. A private dinner with just three people, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and Alexander Hamilton, opens the way forward. Aaron Burr realizes he missed the moment where everything changed. He wasn't in the room where it happened. Of course, it's a longing for power, influence, even basic inclusion, brilliantly described as the room where it happens. Many of us know this dynamic to varying degrees. When did that get decided, we ask? I sure wasn't there. It happens in our families. We're celebrating Christmas when? In our congregation. Who decided to rearrange the chairs that way? Who decides when we use inclusive language or not? We're calling another pastor? It happens in our schools. What? They're putting another new school out there? Happens in our community. They're opening up all the retail stores. Who decided that? Sometimes we need to speak with a measure of humility. While we were invited to be part of the conversation, we opted out for one reason or another. We chose not to speak or to listen to others when decisions were being made. Sometimes we knowingly delegate decisions to those who may know more and whom we trust. Not everybody has to be there to decide everything. Sometimes we are in the room where it happens, but the decision didn't go the way we would have wished. Then we need to ask questions about the larger good alongside our own opinions, wishes, and convictions. And sometimes there is a tacit choice to keep some people out of the room where decisions are made. Historically, these have often been the people most impacted by those decisions. This charge applies to our civil government as well as to the church, sadly. Then we need prophetic voices to act and speak on behalf of and with the marginalized. Some of you have been a part of this important work now and in the past. In the musical, Aaron Burr wants to be in the room where it happens. Historians disagree on the character and legacy of both Hamilton and Burr. And that's not the point of this meditation, such as it is. Instead, let's move along to the exploration of the third room. The room where we are and aren't. Like many of you, I'm not finding these days easy. I miss being in the same room with all of you for worship, the room where we can sing together, interact with happy, sometimes noisy children, high-energy youth, quieter older folks. I miss hearing your laments and thanksgivings, up close and personal. I miss being in the same room for a small group, for our candle lighting and sharing. I miss meals with family and friends, potluck meals at the church, coffee at the brew, supper at Maple Indian. I miss going to the Chicago Symphony with Ellie Kreider and our seats on the upper terrace in that vast room. I've had some days where I miss Michael intensely. I want to be in the room where it happens. Over these weeks of the gospel stories, through Lent and Eastertide, I've longed for the intimacy of the upper room, whether it was large or small, dimly lit, or with windows for light. Then came the possibility of Zoom meetings. And what language do we use? Rooms. We wait for others to arrive in the room. Anna puts us into rooms for coffee time. At first, I chafed, I shouted, I refused. Zooming is not the room where it happens, and certainly not anything like the upper room. The April 22 issue of Christian Century has an article by Melissa Florer Bixler, pastor of Raleigh Mennonite Church and a sister congregation in Central District Conference. The article runs under the title, On Not Getting Used to This. I concur with much, though not all of what she writes. Describing the range of virtual connections she, her family, and her congregation have tried, she says, virtual activities are mere substitutes for a life I love, a peopled life. There is no replacement for humans. I can heartily say yay and amen. And yet, some of you would not accept my dogmatic proclamations and gently nudged me toward virtual connection. Some things work better for me than others. Some days are better than others. I'm appreciative of noon prayers 3 times a week. My small group now meets weekly, something many of us didn't have time for before our lives changed. While I've pretty much given up Facebook, I Zoom with my 3 older brothers every other week now. We've never stayed so connected. I've Zoomed with my GC women friends, one hunkered down in New York City, washing every grocery item that arrives at her door. So now, friends, I've invited you into my inner room, if not my upper room. My experience is very different from those of you working from home, surrounded by young children. In the midst of these various rooms, I want to make these affirmations. At its best, this has become a season of drawing closer to the one who says, "Prepare a room for me." A season of communion rather than isolation. A season of solitude rather than loneliness. A season where the birds and the flowers feed my soul, even when my grandchildren can't. A season of putting down deeper roots rather than skimming along the surface of endless Netflix, high-carb food, overdosing on depressing news and self-pity. But to make these affirmations, I've also needed to own the longing, the loneliness, admit the wasted time, welcome the sense of being at loose ends, confess my envy of others who seem to be in the room where it happens. These days, epiphanies are seldom all of one and none of the other. Rather, the upper room has space for fear and courage, timidity and boldness, selfishness and extending oneself on behalf of the other, both friend and stranger. So friends, I wonder about you. What has been an upper room for you during this time of isolation? How might you make an upper room in your heart and home if you don't already have one? What will you do there? How will you be there to make it a place of connection with Jesus and with others? I end with these short lines, a prayer from the Center for Action and Contemplation. Pray with me. O great love, thank you for living and loving in us and through us. May all that we do flow from our deep connection with you and all beings. Help us become a community that vulnerably shares each other's burdens and the weight of glory. We ask it for your love's sake. Amen.